Eric Larson, good evening. Welcome to the Kentucky Author Forum.
Great to be here.
And over the next hour or so, I hope we'll hear about your book in the Garden of Beasts and also about your very successful practice of the craft of writing nonfiction. Let's start with the setting of In the Garden of Beasts. Berlin, 1933, 1934. You've chosen a time and place when all of your readers know how the story is going to end. The tension here is the people you're writing about don't know how the story is going to end.
Exactly. And strangely enough, I had not actually counted on that hindsight effect until I started hearing from readers who told me that the effect was something like watching a horror film, you know, the kind of thing where, you know, the babysitter is in the house and there's a growling coming from the basement, and you know that the babysitter should not go down in that basement, but she goes anyway. Readers were telling me about this hindsight effect, and what all I had set out to do was to satisfy really a very personal curiosity, which was, if you were alive at that time and you did not know the ending, what would you have thought? What would you have thought when you were sitting in a cafe and you saw Hitler driven by in an open car? You know, would you have been thrilled? Would you have felt fear? Or would it just have been, there goes Hitler?
Or would you have been impressed with the sense of energy and resilience that the German people are exhibiting?
Which probably is the more likely reaction. If you know, I had to sort of think about this for myself. I mean, you know, I'd like to think that I'd be the first to grab a revolver and shoot Goering in the head, but, you know, this was not an option at the time. And what you would have found in 1933 Berlin was a place that was full of energy, full of character. I mean, you would have taken a walk around the Tiergarten. You would not have seen anybody being beaten to death. Well, depending on the day, but you would not have seen it for the most part. What you would have seen, in particular in the Tiergarten, which is the central park of Berlin, and is, by the way, the source of the title of the book.
The Garden of Beasts.
Literally, the Garden of Beasts. Paradoxically, not paradoxically, it was the one safe place in Berlin where you could go and have a lot of confidence that nobody was eavesdropping on your conversations. But if you were to walk through the Tiergarten, what you would see is kindly matrons walking their dogs, you would hear kids playing in the park, and you would see people riding horseback through the Tiergarten. Now, one or two of those people were high-ranking Nazis that might affect your view of your walk in the park. But the point was that there was this overwhelming sense of normalcy with an underlayment of absolute terror.
So here's an irony, perhaps, a sign of the times, perhaps. By 1933, certainly a lot of newspapers or wire services knew that Berlin was a really important place to have a good reporter. Franklin Delano Roosevelt has just won the presidency, and he can't find anyone to become his ambassador to Berlin.
Correct.
Why not?
Oh, the glib answer is nobody wanted the job. You know, it had been vacant. By the time Dodd got the job, it had been vacant for about 4 months.
And so William Dodd, who is the
William
ambassador.
William E. Dodd, who's the ambassador.
Whose family is the center of this
yes,
entire
exactly,
book.
Yes, exactly. The post had been vacant for about 4 months. He had offered it to numerous people, and they had all bowed out in some very, you know, the kind of things we would say, well, no, I have young toddlers, you know, I don't want them, you know, growing up in Nazi Germany. I'd rather not right now, you know, that kind of thing. And so Roosevelt, you know, one day at a meeting, a cabinet meeting, one of his advisors said to him, well, you know, there's this guy, William E. Dodd. How about him? I kind of knew vaguely of him, and he left that. He ended that meeting saying essentially, "Well, I'll think about it." And then, lo and behold, one day, Dodd, this mild-mannered University of Chicago professor, chairman of his department, he's sitting at his desk. Phone rings, picks it up. The guy at the other end is Roosevelt, and he says, "Would you like to be our next ambassador to Germany?" Our first ambassador to Nazi Germany. And here's the thing. And he tells Dodd, I'm giving you 2 hours to decide. 2 hours. But he neglects to tell Dodd that one reason he's calling him is because all these other guys checked out. Nobody else wanted the job.
Dodd's got to be at best his fourth or fifth choice for the job.
Beyond that.
He didn't say, you're my number 10 choice for this job. You've got to do it.
You're my guy, Dodd. Yeah. So Dodd, you know, God bless him, he races home, talks to his wife, and she says, look, this is, you know, essentially, this is the honor that has eluded you throughout your career. And I think that is what explains why he took it, because otherwise it goes against everything he was feeling at the time. Everything else that he was feeling was that he was sick of academia. He wanted to write his own book, The Rise and Fall of the Old South, and finish it. And in fact, he had earlier considered an ambassadorial post as a sinecure, you know, just a job that, okay, put me in The Hague, and I'll do what you do in The Hague, but I'll write my book, you know. And suddenly he's in Nazi Germany.
And it's really, your book is the story of Ambassador Dodd, also his wife and his adult son, but mostly it's about Dodd and his daughter. These are the central characters. Let's start with the ambassador himself, who is reporting to people back at the State Department in Washington, who fit every caricature we've ever heard about diplomats. They're very upset that he's going to run the embassy on a small budget, because that sort of looks bad. You should be throwing big parties and spending a lot of money.
That was especially upsetting to them.
Very upsetting.
And especially the fact that Dodd... This is a very principled thing, though, of Dodd. The nation was in the midst of the Depression, and he felt that in sympathy for Americans who were suffering, he would run this embassy in a frugal way. He took it a little far by bringing his beat-up old Chevy to Germany.
And at times even walking.
At times even walking, much to the disgrace of his chief of protocol.
He was not acting like the old striped pants diplomat.
Not at all.
Did he get it right away? Did he understand that this was prelude to catastrophe that was happening in Germany?
You know, I don't think he got it right away. He eventually did. But Dodd approached this period in kind of a very interesting way. He approached it from kind of a position of willful naivete. That's to say that he was going in with the idea that he was going to be objective. He was going to assess things for himself. As he says at one point in the book, he says, you know, it's best to give men time to try their schemes. He did, however, fairly early in his tenure, in October on Columbus Day, he did something that, you know, from hindsight, we think, gosh, what was wrong with that? And what he did was, at a Columbus Day meeting of the Chamber of Commerce in Berlin, the American Chamber of Commerce in Berlin, which was attended by many high-ranking Nazis and Gestapo, what he did was he criticized the Hitler regime obliquely through historical analogy. The most distant historical analogy that frankly, most audiences today would not even get, mm-hmm. you know, to Gracchus and Caesar and so forth,
so
way back.
Classical illusions.
Of course, the Nazis picked it up, but the beauty of the speech was they couldn't really attack him because he had never said anything specifically bad about Hitler. State Department, on the other hand, took great offense to this as like this shocking departure, you know, from what a diplomat should do.
And the people back at the State Department, as I read them described in the book, for them, number one issue with Germany in 1933-34 is not what looms on the horizon, what hasn't happened yet. Right. It's still making good on what happened before. It's getting repayment of debts.
Repayment of debts accumulated since World War I. Yeah, which, by the way, I'm not sure if everybody's aware of this, but were finally paid off in 2010.
That was a
surprise decision by Germany to just clean the slate.
That was the end of the German war debt.
It was the end of World War One.
World War One.
Yeah. But yes, they were very concerned with the debt, and in fact, that was one of Dodd's primary missions. And when Dodd asked Roosevelt, what about the Jews? And Roosevelt said, you know, how the Nazis are treating the Jews is really a very shameful thing, but we cannot do anything about it, except, of course, if it involves American Jews living in Berlin.
And there would be incidents of an American Jew getting beaten somewhere. This would be something the embassy would have to take over. It's a consular function.
Yeah, one of the surprises to me, actually, about my research, and a lot of things actually surprised me, was that at the time, you know, when if you were... There was a lot of violence initially in Hitler's regime. He was made chancellor early in 1933. There was a major wave of violence against opponents, social democrats, Jews, and so forth. By the time Dodd arrived, violence had fallen off sharply, but the thing that surprised me was that on occasion, there were these attacks against Americans. I'd always thought it was always the Jews, you know. I mean, but you realize when you go back to 1933-34 and look at it through this very precise, narrow window, that things were very nuanced. Like, one of the things I was very interested to see was that Dachau, which was a new camp, had been set up. And it was quite public. It was announced at a press conference. And it was set up to incarcerate primarily political opponents. In fact, exclusively political opponents, social democrats and so forth. And one day, a representative of the Quakers went to visit a friend who had been arrested. He goes to Dachau. He finds it actually, as prisons go, a fairly reasonable place, well-heated, unlike other places, modern, you know. He talks to the commander of the camp, and they talk about Jews. And actually, the Quaker reports that the commander of the camp says, you know, if it were up to me, we would have none of these camps. And he hoped that they would all go away. So they're talking, and the commander of the camp, the Quaker asks him, and says, representative of the Quakers, asks him, well, how many Jews do you have in the camp? And he says, 25. This is out of thousands of prisoners, 25. And the Quaker is very skeptical. He's not taking this at face value. He says, no. He writes this back to his superiors in America. He says, no, there were actually 50. So you get the irony, you know, you get the how different things were then, how nuanced.
Of course, one of the things that that I thought about in reading your book, thinking back to my brief career as a foreign-based journalist and some many drop-ins in East European countries, is that an ambassador, even more so than a foreign correspondent, will get to meet the most charming representatives of the regime, those who will be the most worldly people, who will both be entertained and be entertaining. And there are such people whom the Dodds are interacting with.
Sure. Yeah, one of the striking things about that period was that, well, for example, I mean, we all know Joseph Goebbels today to be one of the most evil characters of the regime, an absolutely a passionate hater of Jews, and also a real expert at propaganda. In 1933-34, even Mrs. Dodd, William's wife, saw him as a coveted party guest. People wanted Joseph Goebbels at their parties because he had a lively sense of humor. Well, a slightly vicious sense of humor, but he had a lively sense of humor. You wanted a good joke? There he was. He could deliver it.
And I guess it should just be said here that in 1933, 1934... the plight of the Jews in Germany should be seen in the context of more than a tolerance of anti-Semitism, a fairly common, genteel anti-Semitism to many of the people who... even Ambassador Dodd, when he finally meets with Adolf Hitler, says, you could deal with your Jewish problem better. There are Jewish problems elsewhere. They deal with it differently.
Well, I found... it is interesting that, first of all, I was very surprised at the extent and intensity of anti-Semitism in America at that point. You know, early public opinion polling was essentially brand new at that point. And one early poll found, I believe it's something like one-third of America found that, felt that Jews had too much power. Something like 25% felt that all Jews should be packed up and shipped back to Europe. Happily, by the way, current statistics are that only 13% of Americans feel Jews have too much power. But I was especially struck by the fact that at the higher levels of the State Department, below the level of Secretary of State Cordell Hull, but the highest levels of the State Department, there was open anti-Semitism. One of the top three operational guys, routinely wrote in his diary about Jews, describing them as kikes. You know, and you have to take a moment to think about this. Okay, this is an exquisitely done diary, typed. This is a man who knew that history would be looking back on him, and yet he still felt no constraint about using the term kike. So that gives you kind of an index on things. But Dodd's own sort of low grade ambient. Man, I hesitate even to say low grade because to me it's binary. You're an anti-Semite and you're evil, or you're not and you're okay. I mean, that might be just a modern day hindsight view. But he expressed this sort of low grade ambient anti-Semitism that came through, for example, in a confidential dispatch that he writes to the State Department, in which he complains that he has too many Jews on his staff. And this is causing him problems with the Nazis. But that particular meeting with Hitler is really very important, not just for revealing that low-grade anti-Semitism in Dodd, but for what Hitler says at the end of that meeting. Now, this is a meeting where Dodd is trying to be sort of the professor, dealing with, you know, the madman, if you will, to steal another title of another book, but we won't go there. So Dodd is trying, he's in professorial mode, and he tells Hitler, he says, you know, we have a Jewish problem in America too, but we have tried to resolve it in more humane ways. And of course, what he has in mind are quotas and so forth.
Quotas at universities.
Which one could argue are not terribly humane. But what happens then is that Hitler, whenever the conversation turned to Jews, would become enraged. Hitler, you know, accuses the Jews during this conversation of raising all this controversy and conflict. And he says, he tells Dodd in a rage, he tells Dodd, if they don't stop this, I will put an end to all of them. And that's in 1934. That's really the first whiff of the Holocaust yet to come, which, of course, is not. It's many years off.
Well, if you had pitched in the Garden of Beasts to your publisher based on the growth of the ambassador in Berlin and his figuring out what was up, on your track record, you still could have gotten published. But I'm sure it was when you got to his daughter, Martha, and the story of her behavior as the ambassador's daughter, that this remarkable story became a must-write, must-publish, must-read.
Well, here's the thing. You know, once I had decided that this is what I wanted to do, that I wanted to get a sense of this era, then it became a process of trying to find real-life characters through whose eyes I could tell the story. And, you know, the trick is maintain point of view. Leave hindsight out of it completely. I mean, I did that to the point where I never refer to World War I because obviously there had not been a World War II. I just referred to the prior war and so forth. But what I came to Dodd first. I came across his diary, and I thought that was very interesting. So, okay, set that aside. Interesting, but personally, I find diplomatic history utterly tedious. So I had no interest in that. I had an interest, but it was later, though, that I came across a Martha's memoir. And as soon as I saw that she had fallen in love with the whole Nazi ethos, she was intoxicated with what she referred to as the Nazi revolution, that's when things coalesced for me. I thought, oh my God, I didn't know any of this. Our first ambassador to Nazi Germany has this daughter who's in love with the Nazis and who sleeps with the first chief of the Gestapo? This is great. You know.
Yeah. That's right. Pay dirt right there.
I have to say also, what sort of informed my choice of these characters is that I am the father of three daughters, you know, and yeah, I am so glad that Martha was not one of my daughters.
Yeah. You know?
but as a writer, I'm just so delighted to have found her, you know, and frankly, I would have liked to go out to dinner with her. I mean, you know, get lucky, but it was the naivete of both.
Yeah.
Both came to this with a different sort of naivete. Dodd with this sort of, as I say, this willful naivete, this wanting to be objective about what was happening. And Martha with this flat out, you know, I love you guys, you know. And then both in the course of that, their first year, conveniently from a narrative perspective, I mean, it really happened in the space of their first year, almost literally from when they arrived to the end of that 12-month period the following July, that they changed, that they saw the truth.
She, I mean, it's a little hard to think of the ambassador and his wife taking their two grown children with them to to live in Berlin, but...
Especially in the height of the Depression, when they were both employed.
Yeah. She'd been working for a paper...
Chicago Tribune. Assistant literary editor.
Had gone to the University of Chicago. I don't know if she'd graduated or not, but she'd spent time there. And friendly with Carl Sandburg and Thornton Wilder.
Can we please define friendly?
Okay.
She had an affair with Carl Sandburg.
Yep.
And just one little footnote. I love footnotes, by the way.
And would have with Thornton Wilder. Had
he had not been interested in other things.
Yeah, yeah.
But one reason... I'm totally flying off on a tangent here, so rein me back anytime you wish. But one reason I love doing my own research, I only do my own research, I don't use research assistants, because one of these little moments happened with regard to Carl Sandburg. I was going through Martha's papers, 70 linear feet of correspondence and love letters and so forth in the Library of Congress. And in one file, in a clear archival plastic envelope, I came across two locks of Carl Sandburg's hair. And I was like, wow, he really was blonde, you know? And his hair was very coarse. I mean, it was just one of those moments where it's very important for me to have tactile, I did touch it, I shouldn't have, but I did. It's one of those moments where I had tactile contact with the past. It's very important to me, because I don't want to get supernatural about it, but it's almost like you channel the past. It just assures you that all this really happened. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now, where were we?
We were right there. The wonderful polar difference between Martha Dodd and her father, the ambassador, is, as you say, he is trying to be the dispassionate, objective historian temporarily a diplomat. And she is not only... literally passionate in her embrace of Nazism, but then takes up with a Soviet agent in Berlin and is equally or more passionate with him.
Fair and balanced.
Yeah, fair and balanced. She didn't take her allegiances lightly.
She did not. And actually the relationship with Boris...
Boris Vinogradov.
Boris Vinogradov. I was, you know, this was like a festival of delights for me as a writer.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I went into it, I didn't even know about Boris, right? So I'm going through her papers, because very importantly, she did not mention Boris in her memoir, which was published in 1939, because she didn't want to get him killed. So there's no reference to Boris. There was reference to him obliquely, and only when you go through her papers do you realize that's Boris. That's Boris. And it's you got to triangulate with her thing. But when I came across these, I guess like maybe three dozen love letters from Boris to her in German, because that was their mutual struggle language. She didn't know any Russian, he didn't know any English, so they made, you know, epistolary love with letters in German. I came across these three dozen letters, had them translated, and I was like, wow. It's like I had died and gone to heaven. It's like this is real. And then later in one of her files, she gives the most detailed account of the early days of their relationship, right down to that wonderful date she has where he takes her to his room in the Soviet embassy in Berlin, and his daughter walks in on them. I just...
Yeah. This is the stuff where if you wrote this as fiction, we'd say
exactly.
this is beneath the movies for television.
Exactly.
This kind of plot twist. It's not... it's just not credible.
That's right.
How long were you involved in writing this book?
You know, it's always hard to say. I mean, the conception for the book was probably... 5 or 6 years ago, but that's not to say that I was working on it for 5 or 6 years solid. That was actually possibly even 7 years, frankly. But you know, there's a process where you start with the grand histories, the like Alan Bullock's classic Hitler, A Study in Tyranny, Ian Kershaw's books, Richard Evans, and then you sort of start circling in, and I found my characters, and then it's all, and then you sort of parachute into the archives. It took probably about 3 years of pretty solid research, and then about 2 years of writing, but there's a year overlap, you know, where you're doing research and writing, you know, because at some point the book just, it just has to come out. And then I go into what I refer to as my page-a-day mode, where I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, write one page. That's my goal. Write a page, come down, have breakfast with the kids, and then go back to the research. And gradually, one page becomes two becomes... And then something I like to refer to as the acceleration effect kicks in, and suddenly I'm doing 10 pages a day, and then the writing is predominant.
It sounds like it requires tremendous discipline, because this is a story, particularly once you start learning the story of Martha Dodd, where you could get lost in this. I mean, you could spend another 3 years writing this. How do you
well,
how do you cut yourself off and train yourself and say, we must publish, we must write?
You know, at this point, it's kind of an instinctive thing. I've done this enough, and it started really when I was writing longish pieces, like when I worked for the Wall Street Journal and magazines. So there's a point where everything starts to sound the same, things repeat themselves, and then you know that you're pretty much done. But also, but now it is this more instinctive sense that this thing is really, you know, it's like you're pregnant, and there's only so long you can keep that baby in there, you know, and that's. That really is, I know that's a glib way to put it, but that really is what it's like. This kid starts sticking out a foot, and then, you know, and the rest, there it comes.
When you were writing for the Wall Street Journal, or for Time, I assume that in addition to consulting documents, you spoke to living people.
Yes.
You interviewed people who were around. The books that you've chosen to write are, for the most part... Well, there are no more people left to talk to. Maybe their grandchildren they're left to talk to.
Yeah, exactly. Well, confession time. When I was working for the Wall Street Journal and doing journalism and stuff, I frankly burned out on living people.
You know? Such a bore.
You know? There's so many times you can get a call from a lawyer. You know, so many times you can do this, and I prefer dead people.
You find they're less likely to complain, is what you're saying. They're
very much so.
How different is it to be trying to gain as clear an understanding, to write as good a description of somebody who helped design the Chicago World's Fair as it is somebody whom you could sit down with and interview for a couple of hours?
You know, in a lot of ways, and I'm not sure that this would be the case for somebody 100 years hence, and that's a whole other issue. You know, what kind of materials will remain for historians 100 years down the road? But in a way, it's easier because when people put their papers into the Library of Congress, when they file their diaries away at Harvard, they are anticipating that after they're dead, these things will be used. It's very unguarded. Nobody's trying to protect themselves. Nobody's trying to protect themselves from somebody, you know, taking their stuff and putting it on YouTube and it goes viral into the shame game. You know, that's nothing like that. So you have these wonderfully detailed letters, like Martha with her Boris love letters. If she were alive, she would probably not even have told me about Boris. You know, I mean, she might have kept that very secret. So in some ways, these old caches of documents. I mean, look at the State Department guys who were writing so disparagingly about Jews.
Right.
Would they tell me that in a face-to-face interview today? No, I don't think so. Well, some might.
But for the Marthas of today, who will be written about in 100 years,
right,
there'll be the 3 million tweets to wade through to try to see what she was thinking every 5 minutes of her of her waking life.
Saw Hitler, LOL, you know.
apart from the fact that the people are dead and can't complain, I assume there's a period, you know, between the 1890s and the Second World War that you've come to just dig into very seriously.
You know, I try not to get typecast. You know, I don't want to stick myself in any one era. I do have a thing for the Gilded Age, and actually for that period, let's say 20 years before 1900, and well, obviously 33 years afterwards. But in that period, and actually it is to me, you know, the sausage being made here. One, and this is a surprisingly important reason, is that people not only wrote a lot of correspondence, a lot of reports, and so forth. They typed them. Now, when I was doing Devil in the White City, as if my wife were here, which she would attest to this, I'm telling you, going through Olmsted's handwritten documents was an ordeal. I mean, there was one day when my wife came into my office and she found me just flat out on the desk with my head down on the desk, just like, I can't do this. I can't do this. And she's the usual wife thing. She says, get a grip.
Very supportive. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like, I don't want to wander too much, but I'm going to. It was kind of like when she came into my office and I was in the midst of working on The Devil in the White City, and this is early in the process, and I was thinking about the, you know, Holmes and the Holmes curse. And
Holmes is the serial killer
in The Devil in the White City.
Who's at the same time as the creation World's Fair in Chicago.
Yes, and there is this, I had come across, you know, repeated accounts of the so-called Holmes curse, all the bad things that happened to people who had done bad things to him, like the jury foreman and so forth. So I was sitting in my office, my wife walks in, and I'm just musing to myself, you know, I don't know if I want to bring this darkness into my home. My wife is a physician scientist. She gave me one of those looks that wives give you.
Yes.
And then she walked out, and that was over.
There's something that you write on your website. You write, a number of readers have asked why there are so few photographs in my books. Yeah. And you say, I'll explain, but first let me throw some napalm on the grill and say this, if it were up to me, there would be no photographs at all.
It's true. And actually, case in point is that one of the things that I read that really kind of got me thinking about this current book was Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. 1,200 pages, tiny type, no photographs. When I talk about this in the South, everybody says it's the Bible, you know. But it's not. It was the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
But when Shira wrote that, William Shira, who had been a correspondent in Europe, when that came out, and I guess the 1960s was when it was final. Was it in the 50s that it was published?
I'd have to go back.
I mean,
what
one could still see on television pictures of Nazis and war stories all over the and Eisenhower had been the president.
That's a good point.
So all of the pictures were in even the heads of this 13-year-old in 1960. But the people you're evoking for us are not. We don't see pictures of ambassador.
Right. Well, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you my approach, and it really has to do with what I'm trying to achieve in these books. My goal is not necessarily to inform, as strange as that sounds. Mm-hmm. My goal is rather to produce a historical experience. That is to say, I mean, my ideal reader is somebody who will sit down late at night on his or her couch, start reading this book, dog asleep at her husband asleep at her feet, and sink into this book, and ideally not emerge until the book is done, and emerge at that point with the feeling that, you know, you've lived briefly in the past. Photographs, to me, and the way especially that they're usually used in nonfiction books, they're usually inserted in a signature, glossy white, you know, it's as visible as a lighthouse beacon. Sometimes there are multiples. And the danger is that as you're reading the book, you will flip back and forth to the photographs, and that takes you out of the dream. In my case, it's a nonfiction dream, but it's a dream that I'm trying to produce with facts and details and so forth, and I want you to sink into that thing and have your own mental pictures. I mean, in Isaac Storm, there are no photographs except on the cover. But fuel to the fire, I describe photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may be perverse. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you someone whom I rush to see a photograph when I get it.
Yeah.
I'll mangle his last name, but it's... It's Potsy...
Hamstengel.
Hamstengel.
I
wanted to see what he looked like. What he looked like. You should explain who he is.
Potsy Hamstengel was this Harvard-trained, once gallery owner, pianist who played late at night for Hitler to sort of apparently the what people believed was that he played late at night to help soothe Hitler's, you know, passions and so forth. But he was this really gigantic man, gigantic hands, spoke, you know, absolutely flawless English.
American-born.
He too became, by all counts, a lover of Martha, but very, very briefly. But he was this extravagant character with an unspellable last name.
And he was a face of the regime to.
It was really unclear how much productive work he actually did for the regime. He was the foreign press chief, and therefore he was exactly in a sense, but he wasn't like the day-to-day operational guy.
Because one of the things that he fits into this part of the story, which to me is very reminiscent of the way the way journalists cover foreign countries that are in turmoil, which is in 1932-33, one could speak of the more moderates within the movement, within the Nazi movement, as opposed to the more extreme people. And there would be one objective of policy would be to try to support the moderates in their efforts.
Right. And it was Dodd's belief, as probably within the first 6 months of when he was there, it was his belief that, initial belief, that he could nurture the moderates. Hofstadgel was a moderate. He was also a cynic. It's pretty clear to me that he didn't really buy the whole deal, but it was a way to maintain a high-profile position in that culture. But Dodd encountered some other characters who, if his diary is to believe, were not at all in tune with the Hitler regime. Case in point, the foreign minister von Neurath. Again, if you can believe Dodd's diary, he had lunch with him one day in a private restaurant off Unter den Linden, sort of the central boulevard that leads from the Brandenburg Gates, but in a discreet place off the boulevard, where von Neurath said essentially that he would like to wake up one day and find that Hitler's gone. You know, that he had no support for the Hitler regime, which is pretty amazing coming from Hitler's foreign minister at that time. Of course, von Neurath, who was actually kept on by Hitler as sort of a way to seduce the West, eventually he was fired and replaced by somebody much more with the program. But that was a very interesting moment, I felt. And they walked together back to their respective offices, and Dodd expressed feeling a certain amount of sadness for the man and for the times.
By the way, you've talked about how he was regarded by the desk, by the Europe people back at the State Department. FDR himself had a more positive view, I gather.
He did, until, of course, at the end, even Roosevelt felt that he could not retain him in the position much longer. He was getting too much pressure from within, but also from the Nazi hierarchy, which personally I think speaks well for Dodd. But I think Roosevelt saw, to the best of what anybody can determine from the record, I think Roosevelt saw Dodd as being exactly the kind of guy he wanted in that position. He wanted, after he got all the turndowns, of course, he wanted a guy who was going to be a model of bedrock American liberal values. And so Roosevelt was a very compelling guy. I mean, if I ever wanted to really come to hate myself, I would do a biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I say that, and I'm not kidding. I mean, before you could do a biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you would have to spend 5 years reading. That's what I mean. But he was an infinitely compelling character, just this affable, smart guy with all these kind of interesting, instinctive ways of managing things, one of which was to hire guys like Dodd without any input from the Secretary of State. He didn't consult with Secretary of State Cordell Hull. He just picked Dodd. So he had this one-to-one connection with Dodd, as he did with other people in his administration. And it was invaluable for him to find out, sort of have these connections that were not filtered by convention and so forth. And so, they had this very interesting exchange where finally Dodd was sending Roosevelt very detailed, very frank reports about how bad things were and about the dangers of Hitler. And that was when Dodd began to turn.
You know, it's interesting when you say that if you wanted to to write a biography of FDR, it would be 5 years of reading. There was a recent profile of Robert Caro in the New York Times Magazine, who's, I think, now into about 30 years of his project of being Lyndon Johnson's biographer. I guess, I mean, it does seem to be a risk that you have here, that you could fall into a...
Well, at least in Carroll's case, at least he's got multiple volumes.
He's gotten multiple volumes
for
much of his
career. It is interesting. I mean, I am actually not, though. I don't have a biographer's. I can't do biography because I just don't think anybody's life is all that interesting homogeneously. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm interested in segments, and it's not again. It goes back to what I'm trying to do. It's not so much that I want to convey all this information. One reason it's so hard for me to come up with ideas for my next project is that I want a real life story that can be that once told will have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Nothing made up. I mean, facts. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole real deal. But we'll have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a built-in narrative arc or engine. Something that actually ascends. You know, and the problem with biography is that there are plateaus in people's lives. I mean, there are parts of people's lives that are flat out boring. And as a biographer, you've got to write them.
That's right. You can skip those.
I know. Well, my biography of Roosevelt would be, okay, he was born. World War II. And then...
Well, one obvious, as you say, the greatest source you can have are these contemporaneous letters that people wrote and the memos that they typed. But you also will rely upon memoirs that people write.
Yes. Very tricky.
How do you deal with the reliability of the witness who's chosen to write a memoir?
It is very tricky, especially with memoirs that were coming out of the Third Reich. In the case of Martha's memoir, as I mentioned, you really have to triangulate. You have to go into everything that is available to really figure out where she's trying to snow you and where she's not. But I found it really pretty credible.
Yeah,
pretty credible memoir. Same actually with Dodd's diary. I mean, you know, there are
questions.
Which
she edited as well.
Which she edited. But, you know, when you go through Dodd's papers, and he has voluminous papers at the Library of Congress as well, piles and piles of things at the National Archives. When you go through his materials, it all tracks really astonishingly well with that diary. I don't think she was playing any games with that. There are other memoirs that, you know, obviously... I mean, especially those by members of the Nazi hierarchy, that one needs to be very careful about. And the best way to deal with those is find out what other people are saying about those memoirs. And you often find that they're not what they seem. It's often been said that there were an awful lot of ambulance drivers in the German army.
Yes. You're a former newspaper man.
Yes.
Newspaper accounts, contemporaneous newspaper accounts. Do you read them and marvel at how well they got it right, or that they had the weather right, and little else? What do you find?
Depends on the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Depends on the reporter. I do find that newspaper reports are very helpful. You know, you still have to be very careful because things that are reported, as we know, being journalists, I mean, as you report something on day one, day two, the picture changes and can change pretty significantly. But, you know, this became very important to me, in particular with Devil in the White City. And I found, the first thing I did with my research was I started reading the Chicago Tribune beginning 2 years before the World's Fair. And I started reading it day by day, happily in my terrific library in Seattle, University of Washington, Suzuki Library. They have the Chicago Tribune on microfilm. And I just, this is going to be my, part of it was my way to delude myself into thinking that I was being really productive on a day-by-day basis.
Did you talk to your wife about this?
She'd given up on me by then. But you know, I was trying to go day-by-day to get a sense of sort of the woof and weave of life in Chicago in that era. And what I found was the Chicago Tribune was really a terrific newspaper in the 1890s, really terrific. And it did provide such things as, you know, things that I really need if I'm going to do what I do. For example, back to Devil in the White City, little things like the fact that outside a store at a particular corner in front of the old Chicago Tribune, where they posted bulletins on, this is, used to be the practice, they would post the day's bulletins face out on the windows, the first floor windows of the newspaper, and people would gather around and look at these things. It was very important to me to know a lot about this intersection, the streetcars that went through, and the fact that outside a cigar store right here, there was a gold lion sitting on the sidewalk. Why is it important? I mean, you know, I think little bits like that help. It just lights things up in the imagination. It helps also to know, in that case, that the streetcars were cadmium yellow, mm-hmm. you know, and all these little bitsy details. And that's where newspapers come in very handy. I mean, you know, I know the word assume means you make an ass of you and me, but at some point you've got to assume that there's some credibility in the reporter, that if he's talking about a yellow streetcar, it's probably yellow, you know? So it's that kind of thing. But it is very tricky, and you can never rely, especially for substantive materials, solely on newspaper.
And you've had other experiences as disappointing as that one was fulfilling?
I can't really cite any particular disappointing thing. It's just because I'm always wary. But you just have to approach it with a certain amount of wariness. You know, just like if somebody walks up to you on the street and is trying to sell you a watch, you know,
I think that's reason for skepticism, right?
Reason for skepticism, but it could be a really good watch.
If it's under here, probably. probably not. It's actually a wonderful story that when Malcolm X was a small-time hustler in Harlem, he learned to sell watches out of his coat while actually having a peddler's license from the city of New York. It sold a lot better if he could...
Classic New York.
If he can do that, yeah. We've left the story of Martha Dodd hanging a little bit with her 1939 memoir and her affair with the Soviet agent.
Yeah.
The end of her story, which is obviously truncated because you're not writing the biography of Martha Dodd, is again incredible, and never would have believed it.
Yeah, it caused me some real issues in terms of how to compose the book, because here was this very interesting trailing story, but the narrative was over. The climax was reached. You know, what I sought to do is like here. And then there's this whole other story about her dalliance, essentially, with Soviet intelligence, even after the war, coming back to the United States. And, she really, what I decided in the end was that she was really a very tragic character. Martha, the thing that defined Martha was a need to be something greater than she actually had the capacity to be. She could never be the great writer that she wanted to be. Believe me,
You've read, yeah.
Well, I tried to read one of her novels. I got it through an antiquarian bookseller online, and thank God, my dog got to it first. I'm serious. My dog. This is no joke. My dog has a thing. She's dead. I'm sorry to say, but she had a thing for old books. She did, but Martha always wanted to be bigger than she was capable of being. And that was the case also with her dalliance with Soviet intelligence. I think she had thought of herself as this player in the world of danger and so forth, when really she was very much a fringe character as far as anybody can really tell. But the true tragedy is, in that era, I'm talking now about the 50s, even if you were just dallying, it cost you. It was very binary. You could have been selling atomic secrets or you could have been Martha. Either way, they treat you the same. And they weren't going to execute... Well, they might have. But so she fled. She wound up in self-exile in Prague under circumstances that were really, really painful for her. And so that's really the sort of tragic arc for her.
Lived to see the Soviet invasion of Prague after the Prague Spring of 1968?
I mean, just one of those... Well, writer's perspective, one of those wonderful moments. I mean, there she is. You know, she's a lefty through and through. She's gone to Prague, and suddenly one day, literally out her window, there are the tanks. You know, and it's like, well, that'll bring you up short. Yeah. You know, but it's also the case that Martha, true to this idea of her always talking a better game and trying to be something bigger than she was. Once, when they were first in exile in Prague, they led a very capitalist lifestyle. You know, thanks to the communist government, they had a multi-story villa. They had a brand new black Mercedes-Benz, and you know, it was those little contradictions that I would make people interesting. I think
your story of your dog, your late dog, who devoured her novel,
And devoured, by the way, one of Oliver Lord, the physicist in Thunderstorm, one of his memoirs, an 1890s book.
Yeah. I
managed to find a copy of abebooks.com, and the library was happy.
So this is was a dog slash literary critic as well.
Exactly.
Which brings me to critics and reviewers.
You said that.
I did. No, after you've invested several years of your life reading, researching, writing.
Where are you going with this?
I'm just wondering, you know, we all, or at least we didn't. I remember, you know, all those movies where the opening night reviews from the drama critics are brought into the star of stage, and everyone looks at the end of it. How much does it matter what people write about you? I mean, are you thick-skinned yet?
No. But you see, but one thing that is central to me is that I do not read my reviews. I do not read my reviews. One time I made an exception. One time I made an exception. It was for Thunderstruck. I was in Washington, D.C. It was on my book tour. I had this great thing set up, a luncheon book club at the Washington Post. It was a beautiful day. I was staying at the Watergate, or the Four Seasons. They put you up in nice hotels on these book tours. You know, went down to breakfast. I was going to see my daughter for the first time after she'd gone to college at Georgetown. It was like everything was shaping up to be perfect. Go down to the restaurant. Not only is it shaping up to be a perfect day, this restaurant had pecan-encrusted walleye on the breakfast menu. I love fish. I love walleye. I was like, this is Washington, D.C. It's died and gone to heaven. Here comes the newspaper. I knew there was going to be a review in the Times that day. So, okay, I'll take a look. It's a great day. What could go wrong? So I open this thing up. I see the headline. It's like, it could be good, could be bad. But it's not terrible. So I start reading. First paragraph in, Janet Maslin called it a flimsy mess.
Not that you remember the phrase. After all these years, not that you could recall it verbatim.
She called it a flimsy mess. And, you know, I couldn't finish breakfast. I paid, I left. And as I left, I was convinced that everybody in the hotel had read the review and knew I was the author. I mean, I felt like a Mel Brooks character. You know, it was a horror. And I'll tell you something. That one phrase ran through my head throughout the creation of this new book.
Really?
Flimsy mess.
You've been haunted by Janet Maslin for all these years.
Apparently, she loved this book.
You wouldn't know. You wouldn't know.
I never read the review, but
you
I'm told.
Never
I'm told.
You're told. I think you've got that right. The very same
and
news.
By the way, one reason that I never. I'm starting to hate you. One reason I don't tell people typically my ideas. Similar kind of thing. I was, I never tell people my ideas. Although we made an exception for this next thing, and you can talk about that if you want, but I won't. So one day we're at the summer house in Long Island. My sisters were there. Everybody's there, you know. And one of my sisters starts badgering me. She says, come on, tell me what you're working on. I said, no, I don't want to. Tell me. So, okay. So I described the plot of the Flimsy Mess book. And she says to me, oh, I wouldn't want to read that. And so that was going through my mind during the whole research process for that book.
And
I'm scared about flying. That's it.
Apart from that, the very newspaper that Janet Maslin reviewed you in very recently had an item, which is, you know, something you're more likely to see about, you know, what Woody Allen's next movie is going to be. That's what makes those. And it says what Eric Larson's next book is going to be about, the Lusitania.
Okay, now, I knew you'd bring that up.
Yeah.
you don't really know what I'm doing.
That's true.
And actually, it was, in fact, there was method in that madness. It's funny, my daughter, my eldest daughter, who's totally caught up in international real politics, works for the State Department and stuff, she sends me an email. She says, "Dad, who leaked that?" I sent her back a text message and said, "We did." And here's why. We're deliberately trying to just get the word out. We're staking this territory. Stay away. Now, as you know, one risk is,
yes,
the unexpected consequence could be that a million other people now are going to do the book, right, like in a year.
Yeah.
And then I'm dead in the water, so to speak. You know, I mean, it's I apologize.
But you think that would, I mean, I guess people would assume they don't want to write, we think they wouldn't want to write the other book about the Lusitania that comes out.
I don't know. We have other things up our sleeve.
do you have a sense now of how many years it will take you to publish the next book?
I know exactly how long it's going to take.
To be a centennial?
Yeah.
That's good. So you have a serious deadline coming up here.
I do.
And and you're deeply into it already.
I am.
And is there a time when you're doing this now when you are, no recreational travel, no long trips to visit with a daughter or something because you're that deeply immersed in this thing? Or do you need a fairly normal life even in your...
I lead a fairly normal life because I have the luxury of being able to work, full time, however long I want to apply to it. I don't have a second job. I don't have a newspaper column that I'm trying to maintain. And happily, my daughter who's in D.C., I visit her and I go to the Library of Congress and the National Archives. It's like, the best of both worlds. I just went on a research trip to the Library of Congress and spent each, full days in there. And each night, because my daughter is poor and is just finishing graduate school, she arranged reservations at all these great Washington restaurants. For her and her friends, by the way.
Do you assume that, say, 10, 20 years from now, it will still be necessary to go to libraries and to sit in libraries and look at documents on real paper, or at some point does it all get to you over the web and digitized?
I don't think it's ever going to all be on the web, and I certainly hope not, because it's no fun sitting there in front of a computer 8 hours a day printing things out. It's just no fun. And you lose that contact. I mean, there's nothing like going to an archive, picking up a letter, like Boris's love letters. And actually, I've just gone through some fascinating love letters involving this project that shall have no name. But there's nothing like picking these things up, touching this letter, knowing that the person who wrote it had done it, had touched it, again, it's that connection with the past, and it's really an amazing feeling.
Well, Eric Larson, the way that you described your ambitions for a reader when you do a book pretty well describes how I felt reading your book, and it has been even better to hear you talk about it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.